This is really nice being able to silence a room by just coming up here. So thank you for that. Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, thank you for coming to the Woman and Work, the Changing Meaning of Ambition. I'm really excited to be here. My name is Jennifer Briere. I work for National Grid. I'm the VP of HR Business Partnering and Strategic Workforce Planning. And the advancement of women is something that I'm personally extremely passionate about. And so I'm really excited to help MC the session for three really incredible women. So I'm really looking forward to the session. A little bit about National Grid. As many of you know, you are customers of ours if you live in upstate New York, downstate New York, or Massachusetts. And we have a lot of really incredible women working for us, Marcy Reed being one of them, who's the Mass Jurisdictional President. So many of you may have seen her recently. And we also have our CFO happens to be a woman. So it's a really great place to work. Still a long way to go in a traditionally male-dominated industry. But we are also a proud sponsor of the Mass Conference of Women. The Conference for Women offers really a blend that you'll see of practical tools, advice, inspiration, as you've seen from this morning, and peer networking. So certainly take advantage and maximize the opportunity that you have here. So thanks for participating. Now I'm really excited to introduce Jane Steinmetz. Jane Steinmetz is the first woman to lead an office for a Big Four accounting firm in the Boston area. She brings over 20 years of experience in serving Fortune 100 clients, leading high-performing teams, and advocating for change to local legislature. Responsible for all aspects of the New England practice, Steinmetz manages over 2,100 professionals who make an impact in the area, both the economy and the community locally. She is passionate about personally making a difference in women advancement, youth mentoring, and equality for all. Jane is currently a trustee and executive committee member of the Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation, board member of the New England chapter of the National Association of Corporate Directors, Massachusetts chapter of the United Way, and serves on the Boston Club Corporate Advisory Board and Massachusetts Business Roundtable. She is also a member of the Massachusetts Bar Association and volunteers with many local charitable organizations. Jane has been named the Boston Business Journal Power 50, Girls Leap Honoree of the Year, and one of Massachusetts Society of CPAs 2018 Women to Watch. Please put your hands together and welcome Jane.
Thank you. Well, thank you, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Great. I am so excited about this discussion because I did have a chance to read the book that we're going to be talking about, and it's amazing. So I'm going to make a promise to everyone here. Everybody here is going to take valuable insights away from this discussion, and that is irrespective of whether you are in college, you recently graduated, or you're someone like myself, you've been practicing for 25 years, raising a family, you know, and trying to get that all done. So Hannah Schenck and Liz Wallace, thank you very much for your work. Your work is the ambition decision, what women know about work, family, and the path to building a life. And this book is a compilation of research that they did surrounding 43 of their classmates that they graduated with from Northwestern, graduating in 1993, I believe.
Yes. Yep.
And what it explores is what were their ambitions when they graduated college? Did they live up to those dreams that they had early on? And should that be the measure of success? Or should success be defined by our evolving aspirations as they evolve for our lifestyles and our life stages? What I thought was insightful is what is intuitive when you think about it, but when you read it on, you know, in words, it makes a lot of sense. We're kind of figuring it out as we go. It's not as if we have a playbook. You know, it's when you think about the opportunities we have in front of us and the roles that we can take on, they're not the same that our grandmothers had. And for many of us, our mothers. It's not like I could say, well, gee, how did my grandmother handle the international assignment? Like, it did not, wasn't around back then, right? So that's what makes the journey of these 43 women so compelling, because it helps us frame our playbooks. So with that, Hannah, you are a writer, You're a designer, and you are a technologist for 20 years.
Yes.
And what I think is really cool is she worked for the Department of Homeland Security, Digital Services. Yeah, I think that's very cool. You are a frequent contributor to the New York Times, to the Washington Post, among other publications. And then, Liz, you are an editor of, you have been an editor of fashion and entertainment magazines of the likes of Vogue and 17 and Us Weekly. You're also a frequent contributor to well-known publications. With that as your backgrounds, what inspired you, both of you, to do this research and write this book?
So this project began, as many great things do, with a midlife crisis. the seed of many wonderful things. We had both recently turned 40, and we were college friends, but we had fallen out of touch. And I was actually in spin class, also another great starting point, and was sort of reviewing my life choices and kind of where I had, how I had come to the place that I was in, which was not a bad place. I had a job, and I had a family, and I had a marriage, and I had all of the things that should, you know, all of the pieces that you want to put together. But I just felt stuck, and I felt like it was so much harder than I anticipated it being. And I started wondering, was this just me? Was this just like I could not figure out how to get it, put all pieces together in a way that was not really, really hard and exhausting? Or was this a systemic issue? So I wanted to, I sort of was flashing back to my memories of my college friends and what we wanted to do when we graduated and thinking about how they all seemed really ambitious, and I'd fallen out of touch with a lot of them. And but Liz and I had gone to college together, and we were sort of sporadic, you know, get together once a year for drinks, friends at that point. And so I emailed her and said, "Do you feel like, you know, I think I might be having a midlife crisis. how are you doing?" Do you want to?
And I said, "Yeah, maybe me too. Should we get together and talk about it?" And you also said, "I might be having a midlife crisis or maybe an idea for a documentary film."
Yes.
One or the other.
Right.
So, or maybe both.
So we started talking and we started sort of reminiscing about our friends from college, and we're also, Liz also remembered them as being very ambitious, and we were like, well, whatever became of them? Maybe one of them has kind of figured out, or all of them, except for us, have figured out how to do this thing in a way that doesn't feel so hard. And so we started interviewing our friends, and we had actually been in the same sorority, which looking at us might be, might not seem like sorority people, but or sort of like the alternative sorority. I don't know. So we decided to interview everybody. So we started by having some initial conversations, and those initial conversations were so interesting and so compelling that we were just like, more and more and more, we want to talk to more people. And we ultimately decided to interview 43 of everybody we had graduated with from our sorority. So everybody from the class of 93. And that was the start of this project.
Awesome. Okay, so first question. If you Google ambitious women, it's amazing what kind of pops up from that search, okay? And here's some of the things. Do ambitious women scare you? Can women really be both ambitious and likable? And this is my favorite. Men still aren't comfortable with ambitious women. So this is some of the associations that you see in terms of associations related to women and ambition. And do these associations, in your opinion, and based on your research, does it affect how women pursue or not pursue their ambitions?
Well, Jane, by way of answering that first question, ambitious women excite me, actually.
Yes,
What was interesting was that when we started interviewing our friends, one of the first questions we asked them was, "Do you consider yourself ambitious?" And almost 100% of them said, "Absolutely," no matter where they had ended up in their lives. And this was interviewing them between 2014 and 2016. Almost 100% of them proudly said, "Yes, I am ambitious," whether they were a Fortune 500
C-suite executive or a stay-at-home mom. And one thing that Hannah and I have talked about vis-a-vis that was, you know, when we were growing up, you know, kind of in elementary, junior, and high school, we sort of grew up with the idea of this ambitious woman as like the Tiger Lady, the Sigourney Weaver character from Working Girl, Diane Keaton from Baby Boom, either being really frazzled or just mean and kind of not very multidimensional. Mm-hmm. You know, but we, but coming of age, you know, in the early 90s, we, and during Riot Girl times and kind of the hybrid of the sort of transfer to second and third wave feminism, we were like, you know, of course we're ambitious. We're going to get out there and we're going to do it all. And so we really kind of grew up, I think, our generation being the first one to kind of reframe ambition as a positive. And for us and for our friends, it really was a given. And so we found that it turned those earlier stereotypes, our interviews turned those earlier stereotypes on their heads, because all of our friends strongly, strongly and proudly embrace their ambition, whatever that looked like for them.
That's awesome. And I like the way that you mentioned that it's almost like first generation ambition is ambitious women who can do it in their own style. Because back in the day, it might have been that some women felt like they had to be very aggressive, you know, to get, and maybe they needed to back in the day. So it's, I like that phrase, first generation. So in your research, you both identified internal and external obstacles to women pursuing their career ambitions. What would you say are some of the more prevalent obstacles and any tips as to how to get around them?
So the biggest obstacle that we routinely heard was somebody's partner or spouse. And I will explain that a little bit. So the women who were married or partnered with people who were extremely supportive of their careers, and not just in a, you know, pat you on the back, go get them, honey, kind of way, but in a hands-on, I will free up time for you kind of way. I will take ownership of household responsibilities. I will take ownership of children, and I will like it. Not, you know, I will do it begrudgingly because I'm helping out, but it's a part of my job to do this. The women who were partnered with people who thought about their own role that way were able to succeed and achieve their goals and become high achievers. Of the women who we interviewed who were sort of C-suite level people, 50% of them were partnered with people who stayed at home or had flexible jobs. So the biggest obstacle, conversely, was women who were partnered with people who helped out or who just did not embrace that role, struggled. They struggled to find time. So, for example, we had one friend who had... she was in financial services. She had stayed at home. She didn't actually plan to stay at home, but when her daughter was born on 9/11, and she felt like, I cannot go back to work. So she left the workforce, and she ended up having two more children and being out of the workforce for a period of time. And then when the financial crisis hit in 2008, she felt like, I want to go back to work. I never really intended to stay home. I want to be contributing financially to our stability. And she ended up going back, getting a pretty demanding full-time job. In a little side anecdote, I will just say that the way she did that was to sit in the lobby of her local bank until they offered her an interview. So just a little tip.
She made friends with the receptionist, actually.
Yes.
And said, please get my resume to the hiring manager.
Yes.
And she did.
Yes. But she told us that it was hard. It was hard because her husband, first of all, was used to her doing everything. And so he would take on stuff, but he really viewed it as helping out. And she said to us, you know, I need him to own things. I need him to do more than like, oh, by the way, I remembered to get the dry cleaning today. Like, you have to own that the dry cleaning is your thing, and I don't have to have the mental space to think about it. So that was a huge obstacle, was that women who did not have partners who were supportive in the most important way.
That's hits home for me because I have a stay-at-home husband, and I don't know what I would do if you know, I didn't have that flexibility. This morning he had a doctor's appointment, and so I had to get four kids off to school and two dogs to the groomers. They're Newfoundlands. And I was just like, I was that frazzled person that you were talking about earlier. So I can see how that would be definitely one of the bigger obstacles.
Yes. Well, and I mean, in today's world, you have to be available for that 7 a.m. meeting, or you have to be, you know, if the CEO is like, oh, I need you in Cleveland tomorrow, you have to be able to do that.
Right.
So women who had constructed their lives in a way that enabled them to do that could succeed the way that they wanted to.
Very
interesting. Do you want to add anything to that?
Just that there was this. We also saw this outside of the corporate world for people who aren't necessarily on the corporate track. You know, people who were... You know, worked in the arts or were screenwriters, but those who partnered with people who prioritized their careers equally to or higher than their own saw greater career success, and those who the women who did not prioritize if they had a spouse and if the spouse was a male, if they did not prioritize de facto their husband's career over their own just because of an institutionalized gender bias, but consciously talked about what their roles were going to be in the house and their careers, saw greater achievement of their goals.
Okay.
We have lots of anecdotes on that, but
yeah.
I think that covered it.
So interesting. So your research centered on what were the goals that women set early on in their career, getting out of college, but then your research also showed that those goals morphed and changed over time to fit the individual's lifestyle at that in life stages. Do you think we put too much emphasis on how we're measuring up to the goals we set early on in our lives?
Well, that was part of why we initially started this project, because we thought, although we weren't entirely sure, and we didn't entirely remember what our goals were in 1989 to a T, but we did somehow feel that we had perhaps either fallen short of them or maybe sidestepped them or gotten waylaid a little bit along the way. And that was one of the impetus that prompted us to start these interviews. But what an interesting thing that we found was that we started every interview by asking them, when you got to college, what was your dream? How did that turn out? And they all actually very strongly remembered their college dreams. And some of them kind of came close to that, and some achieved many other things far afield from what that was. But one of the interesting things that we found was that the women who came out of college with knowing that they wanted to be successful and that they wanted to be an achiever, but were a little bit flexible about what that was going to look like professionally, seemed to end up in a better place. That's a hard thing to measure. But seemed successful and happy in their lives. Not that the others weren't happy, because they were and they had made some other choices. But what we found was that there were a number of women who. A number who wanted to pursue careers in the arts, who were voice majors or writing majors, screenwriters, what have you. And some of those achieved that and others did not. But that those who said, okay, well, I want to go into business and I want to be a successful businesswoman and I know I'm good at math and I'm good at talking to people, those were the women that basically ended up in the C-suite careers. Mm-hmm. But we asked them, do you have a passion that is related to your job? And they said, I can't really say that I have a passion, no, but I feel really great about going to work every day and earning a salary that can support my family and getting a lot of professional validation and numerous promotions and having my career be something that I can be proud of with my children and my partner and my community, and being seen as a woman leader, that's really important to me. And so one of our takeaways in the book is that the women who didn't necessarily pursue passion exclusively, but pursued things that A, they were good at and that they knew would lead to economic, not necessarily lucrativeness, but economic freedom or independence, had careers that were very fulfilling to them. Do you want to add to that at all?
Just to say this, I mean, those women met that goal. Mm-hmm. If they set mm-hmm. as a goal, I want to be economically independent, and I want to do something that is, you know, intellectually challenging and that I enjoy. I don't want to get up and, you know, hate what I do, but there's flexibility. I don't have to check off all of the box. My career doesn't have to check off every single box. I don't have to feel like this is my, my passion that mm-hmm. I am just living for and this is my thing. It was enough for them to feel like I'm good at it, I'm appreciated, and I earn a living. And they felt satisfied with that, as opposed to women who really put everything into the career and felt like, well, if I'm going to be away from my kids and I'm going to work really hard, it has to just be so deeply, innately fulfilling. Often struggled to find something that, you know, met those really, really high standards.
That's remarkable. So basically, if I'm hearing correctly, those that were kind of less rigid and said, okay, I'm not going to draw a line and I'm going to go from where I am today to X position. And yet those, you know, and they did not do that and they allowed their career to ebb to where it needed to go, were more successful. That's really interesting because I heard the statistic that folks getting out of college today, they will have 7 different jobs in 5 different industries that do not exist today. And when I first heard that, I said, well, how is that possible? And then I looked at the top 25 companies, Boxed, Amazon, Uber. They didn't exist before. Yeah. So I was like, oh, maybe. So now if you kind of put that into the context of people shouldn't be very rigid mm-hmm. and allow themselves to step out of their comfort zones and they could actually be more successful in that, and in the environment that we're in today, that's really meaningful.
Well, and it's also almost the opposite of the advice that you are given,
yes.
which is like find your passion,
right.
and find
and
the thing you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, in some ways, some of the women who had felt like, well, my passion isn't my job, were almost a little apologetic about it because, like, it's so in our culture that you mm-hmm. should just love what you do. Actually, we did our book launch at WeWork, and WeWork's motto is, do what you love. And we're in this giant building, and I'm like, really, does everybody here like wake up every morning and is like, I love it. I love my work. It's just such a burden to put on the thing
right.
that it pays
right.
your rent, you
right.
know?
Right.
So the women who, you know, interestingly, who didn't have to, you know, feel like they had to marry their passion with their work. Mm. We had one woman, actually, who was one of our highest achievers who is in insurance, and she was like, not everybody, you know, most people don't dream of going into insurance. But once you get into it, it's actually really yeah. interesting. And so people who had that attitude, you mm-hmm. know, could ebb and flow with where things took them.
That's awesome. So, this question is actually my personal favorite, so I want to make sure we get to it, because it's this catch-22 that we find ourselves in. So, you know, some women will have the sense that if they pare back from their career, focus more at home, they might be failing as professionals, the professional goals that they set. But, flip side, if they have a highly demanding job and it challenges their time at home, they could be failing as a mother. So then you're in this catch-22. Not that I've suffered from this, like, every day. So you're in this catch-22. Like, you're ebbing and flowing into, you know, do I put more into this, into that? How do you get out of that, you know, that kind of circle that we create for ourselves? And think about, in addition, a way that helps us find that equilibrium.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we talk about in the book is that the women who were able to, in general, the women who were high achievers, were able to compartmentalize to some degree and set boundaries. Mm-hmm. So, and were very clear about what the boundaries were. So they would say, this is what I can give. This is what I can do. And that's just how it's going to be. Which is not to say that they didn't miss their children, mm-hmm. Or maybe wish that they could, you know, be present at more activities. Mm-hmm. But they came to terms with it. They were okay with it. So we had one woman who said, I do one school event a year. My mm-hmm. children know I do one school event a year. I tell them, pick one at the start, mm-hmm. and we're all on the same page. We all have the same understanding, so nobody's disappointed. We had one woman who said she can host one sleepover a year. That's what she can do. So her kids know.
Only one.
One and done, she said. So, yes. So.
I got to take a script out of that.
I know.
Because I got to tell you, I have a sleepover every weekend at my house.
I know. We were like, that's genius.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's genius.
So they were very good at setting boundaries about what they could do and having everybody be on the same page. And then the other piece, do you want to talk about the non-negotiables?
The other piece of that was, well, and so the flip side of that was the women who really felt like they had a burning need to do everything the best and the most. And you know, I'm sure there are a lot of us like that here, but who have to really kill, who want to really, really kill it at work and also want to pack homemade lunches for their kids every day and want to be able to go to every first Friday meeting with their kids and want to be able to run trail marathons on the weekend and volunteer and not give up anything. And we found those women to be really the most frazzled. But one thing that we talk about in our parenting chapter is that for every woman we interviewed who had children, she had a specific and articulated, once we prompted her on it, list of what she considered her non-negotiables around parenting, and they were different. Some had crossover, but they were different. Like Hannah and I each have a list, and they can change from year to year. But that, for example, I for many, many years, I'm easing up on this a little bit now, but refused to let my children get school lunch and had to pack and had to oversee the packing of their lunches in like just the right plastic reusable container every day, no foil, no waste. And Hannah is much more comfortable letting her kids make their own lunch or get school lunch. And we saw that the women who could identify what their non-negotiables were, what the things that made them inherently feel like a parent or a mother were, that once they identified those, they then would be able to identify what some of the things that were not non-negotiable, sorry, that's a double negative, and maybe let those fall by the wayside or let somebody else do them or just kind of drop them altogether, therefore freeing up more time for other things that you also need to do in your life, like your paying job or your trail marathon running or, you know, whatever, volunteering.
Brewing beer.
Yes, or brewing beer or making bread. I mean, there's a million things that we all have that we want to do. But really, yeah, that one of the very valuable things came to setting limits, even within your own psyche, and letting go of some of the things that you think, there's nobody else in my family who could possibly do that. Like, nobody else can empty the dishwasher as well as I can, so I'm going to have to be the one to load and empty it. My mother-in-law's that way. Nobody else in the family is allowed to touch the dishes. She's 78, and she's still loading the dishwasher four times a day. But once you can, you're good at that? Okay, good. But so acknowledging, identifying what those are, and then letting some of them go can be incredibly liberating, if that's not an overstatement of the word.
And one little coda to that is that an interesting thing we found was that for 100% of the women that we interviewed, making the pediatrician appointments was a non-negotiable. Oh. They all made the pediatrician appointments. They all felt like this was a thing that was so ingrained in motherhood and such a part of motherhood. They didn't always go to them. They didn't always take them, but they had to make them and know that they were scheduled. So
interesting. I think the most liberating thing I found is that one of my twins can make the lunch for the other twins.
That's awesome.
Now, on those kind of the guardrails that they established personally, did any of them have similar guardrails at work? You know, like one of the things I find is you take on a role and everyone assumes you're going to do exactly what your predecessor did. And so when I take on a role, I say no, because I've got four kids at home and I can't really do what was usually he did, you know, in that role. Did they set limits at work as well?
So some of the women did. So one of the things that we haven't really fully articulated here, but is a theme in the book, is that the women that we interviewed fell into three distinct paths. So one were, as we've been talking a lot about, the high achievers, and these were women who were really dedicated to moving up at work and had professional success, were recognized in their fields, were C-suite adjacent. And then we had women who were opt-outers who had chosen to stay at home after their first child or a subsequent child. But then there was this group in the middle that were the flex-lifers. And these are the women who are doing, who did exactly what you are talking about. So they essentially, although we don't frame it this way in the book, but I think it's a great way to think about it, they set boundaries at work. And they said, my work has to fit within this certain box, which is that it needs to, I need to be able to, you know, leave it, come in early and leave at 3 to meet the school bus, or I need to not have to travel that much, or I need to not be on my phone answering emails on the weekends, or, and so they purposefully did not pursue promotions where that, you know, where they knew they would have to be in a role like that. We had one woman who is a, works, she's a lawyer, and she works for a basically a women's defense, battered women's defense fund. And she, we asked her, do you want to be a director? You know, how come she's been in the same position for like 15 years? And we said, would you be interested in moving up and running an organization like this? And she said, no, because then you'd be getting emails from me at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I don't want my life to look like that. So absolutely, women, some of them, you know, put, basically put a box around what they could do parenting-wise, and some put a box around what they could do work-wise, and to some extent that defined which path they fell into.
And can I add one more thing on that? A woman who is not in the book, but who I met at a conference recently, who is the president of a winery, she told me...
How cool is that?
She has... yeah, very cool job, very cool woman. And she is an athlete. She, she told me about 3 or 4 months into her job, she had kids who play lacrosse or something, and she said, you know what, I, on days that my kids are playing lacrosse, it's really important for me to be there. I'm going to leave at 5 o'clock those days, and I'm the president of this company, and I want to set an example, sort of a trickle-down theory, that this is a family-friendly company, but that really has to start from the top. But she said she didn't, and she was the president of the company, and she said, though, that she didn't feel comfortable doing that until she, because Jane, you said, you know, you, your predecessor might have done things differently than you, that she didn't feel comfortable doing that until she was, until she had, like, gotten her feet a little bit wet. But then she was like, actually, I'm in a leadership position to shape the work culture here, so it is important that I do this and articulate that I'm doing this, and I'm not sneaking out and like leaving my light on and leaving my purse on the chair pretending like
I just went to get
a coffee. But I'm going to tell people I'm leaving. I'll be back on my computer at 7:30. If anybody needs me, you can email me. And if you need this kind of arrangement, we can, you know, let me know, and we'll work that out. But so,
and that's really a good message for everybody in the room, because we're all role models, whether we know it or not. So if you're sneaking out, you're sending a message that, gee, to have a balance of any degree and raise kids, you know, you need to kind of sneak out. Or they think you're still working. So now you're sending the message that, well, if you're going to be in this company, you got to work all the time. I struggled with that. Now when I leave early, I let everybody know, I'm going to a, you know, concert for my kids. Because they need to hear that you can do that. So I think that's in any stage, too. But I know it's hard. So that's interesting. So this next question kind of morphs into some of what we were talking about, the proverbial balance, you know. And so in your research, balance shows up, but, you know, as a key factor in women's lives and how to balance work and family and marriage. You've mentioned some, but any other strategies that you've learned through your research that can help have that balance in the professional life and in the personal life?
Well, one of the things, one of the kind of big takeaways at the end of our book is that ambition can look different at different points in your career, and that a lot of our friends had their ambition ebb and flow at different times in their careers. And one example is this woman who's the the legal director at the Women's Anti-Violence Project, she said, you know, right now I consider myself, we considered her, but she didn't articulate it this way, a flex lifer, where two days a week I can leave and be at the bus stop and meet my kids at 3 p.m. And then on the flip side of that, I go in at 7, mm-hmm. 2 mornings, and sometimes I work weekends or answer emails at, you know, 10 o'clock at night. And she said, you know, right now I have a more flexible schedule and I'm not reaching for the stars, but when my kids get a little bit older, I feel like I'm gonna owe it back to the working universe to pay back that time. And I'm gonna really, I don't want to use the words lean in, especially since Michelle Obama's been talking about that recently. Yeah. But I'm going to kind of give my all more to my career. And maybe even then, when her children are a little bit older and more self-sufficient, then pursue the executive directorship, mm-hmm. you know, whatever that means, whatever that looks like in her life. But that right now, this is what I can and want to give at work. But in 3 years, it might look different. You know, so one of our things that we saw, because we examined these women and their careers over 20 years of them telling, not 20 years of them telling us their stories, but hearing their stories and what happened in their lives over a 20-year period, was thinking about playing the long game in your career and knowing that the decisions that you make, that the micro decisions that you make, sometimes every day, but definitely every year, mm-hmm. and at every step in every job you pursue and promotion you pursue or eschew, that those will have implications long term, and that to think when you are in your 20s about how you want your career to look in your 40s and 50s and kind of make decisions along the way in that way, you know, and that you know, as one woman put, these are her words, not mine. You know, she's like, I was balls to the wall with my career for 20 years. And, at age 45, she got married for the first time. And she has a stepchild, and she said, you know, and she, owns her own PR company. And she said, you know, now is, I think I might take a happy derailment now and kind of pull back a little bit, continue running her company mm-hmm. and continue working. But, you know, she has a partner and kind of wants to travel a little bit and enjoy her life being married for the first time. And so she, as someone who, not related to having kids, is scaling back a little bit at 45 when she's been working this way. So I think kind of giving ourselves a break, and if you can make this work economically, financially, logistically for yourself, knowing that it is okay and being okay with that, that there might be career ebbs and flows mm-hmm. and work ebbs and flows, and that may and very likely could shift around having a family, you know, not only around a family, but that is obviously a big factor in that can shape mm-hmm. women's careers and men's too. Yeah. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that once we kind of came to that realization, it was sort of a relief to feel like, okay, I don't have to do everything right now. Just knowing that you have the option to, this is what I'm doing today, and maybe this is what I'm doing for 6 months or 3 years, and 3 years from now, I might have some completely other thing that I want to do. I might just feel like I want my life to look totally different, and having the option to do that. And one thing I'll just add that was really interesting was because we interviewed these women over a period of 3 years in some cases, not on purpose, but it just, mm-hmm. we were doing other things. So it, you know, we were working and whatever. So this project kind of ebbed and flowed for us. But it was interesting to be able to see what happened to women over the course of 3 years. And we had one friend who was a screenwriter and a successful screenwriter. And when we talked to her, and also has 2 children, and the first time we talked to her, she said, I'd really love to direct, but it's just not something that will work for my life. Being a screenwriter is a great job for being a hands-on parent. Mm-hmm. And then the next time we interviewed her, she was about to direct a big budget Hollywood movie.
Wow.
And figured out how to make it work. Yeah. So what was so interesting was she was so like, there's no way I cannot possibly do it. And then, you know, 6 months later, she's like, oh yeah, and by the way, I'm directing a big movie. So just that, like, you know, when you're in the moment, sometimes it just feels like these other things are impossible, but to know that you do actually have the option to move around. Yeah.
Great. So If I could, I'd like to personalize it a little bit. So you mentioned over the course of 3 years, you've had these conversations with these amazing women, intimate conversations, and you compiled it into your book so neatly for all of us. But you know, really had that one-on-one conversation with all these women and understood their journeys and how their ambitions changed. Having done all that, having researched all that, how has it impacted your own kind of personal journey, your ambitions, your goals? Because you are the ultimate learners of this work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in a couple ways. Mm-hmm. So very personally, this project was life-changing for me. I started out this project, I was running my own company and had been feeling like I'd been doing that for a long time and I wanted to do something else, but didn't know how to get there because I also liked being able to be around for my kids. But I also had that, you know, they were getting a little older and I started feeling mm-hmm. a little bit more of that burning career ambition. And when we interviewed, when we realized that there were these three groups, that there were high achievers and opt-outers and flex lifers, I realized I had been living this flex life, which first of all gave validity to mm-hmm. the existence that I had. It wasn't like, oh, I'm just kind of like failing over here and failing over there and failing all over the mm-hmm. place. It was actually choices that I had made and value, you know, ways that I was living my values, essentially, of like, I want to be around for my kids and I also want to work, and that was what I had put together, and that there were so many other women who were doing the same thing, and that just giving a name to it really made it feel like, oh, it's actually a thing. It's not just like I'm flailing. But I also, in doing these interviews with these high-achieving women, started to think, I think I'm ready to be a high achiever, because I just loved how they talked about their jobs and how they just seemed to really radiate confidence. And I thought, you know, I've spent this good chunk of my life being a flex lifer, and I'm really happy that I got to be super hands-on with my kids, and now I'm ready to do something else for a while. And I ended up taking a job in a totally different city for a year when I was, this was at the White House in the Department of Homeland Security, which was sort of this dream job that presented itself. And I just felt like I got to grab it. Mm-hmm. And I think that I would never have even considered doing that if not for this project and sort of having this model of what that kind of life looked like, and that I could, if these other women could do it, that I could do it too.
Awesome. And for me, kind of underscoring Hannah's point, interviewing all of these women, one of our friends said, we interviewed her, I think three, maybe four times. She said, gosh, when you guys interview me, we did them all over Skype. Whenever we talk, it feels like group therapy. And I need like a full day to compress after our conversations. They were very, very personal and very intimate. And the first like six interviews we did, every single woman cried. And slowly tapered a little bit after that. I bring up the group therapy comment because hearing these women's stories and us sharing ours with them, and then getting the book and their stories out into the world and hearing other women's stories who have emailed us or talked to us, you know, met us at conferences, has really shown me kind of how imperative it is to be a working woman in the world today, to have a support group of women around you. And it sounds cliche and cheesy, but actually having people who are in your field or doing what you are sort of doing or what you want to be doing, having a model or a template for what that looks like, having mentors and mentees, and having other women to talk to about your struggles, even though it seems like minutiae sometimes, having that there is just essential. And that is what this became for me too. And I'm kind of pivoting my career too, but Jen's up there like, so I think she might be calling time.
Oh, stop. Yes.
Oh, well, sorry.
If you end up putting together this group therapy thing, please invite me.
Okay. All right.
I would love to be part of that. So I've been hogging all the questions and the time of these amazing panelists. And so I'm going to turn it back over to Jen, who's going to take us to the next.
Yeah. So thank you. And I mean, you've given some tidbits that I think
think mm-hmm. we all can relate to. Lacrosse is one. That's one thing that I hold sacred. I go to my son's lacrosse games, and I let my daughter pack her lunches. And every once in a while, she sneaks in a little candy bar, and I let her. So there are things you can do. So thank you so much for this. I think the research and the conversation was extremely valuable. So what we're going to do is we're going to open it up to questions. For those that have questions, please feel free to start coming up to the mics. But before I do that, you know, you've given us a lot of information. Is there one bite-sized nugget that you've taken away that you'd like to kind of share that was most impactful for you, Jane, Hannah, or Liz?
So I think that one of the big things that came out of this, which we've really alluded to, is that women have agency. You know, this really started with us feeling like, why is this happening to us? Why are we here? How did we get to this place? But the realization that actually you own these decisions. You can decide, we can look at how your time breaks down and say, you know what, this chunk of stuff, I'm not going to do that anymore because I need that chunk of time to do, you know, whatever it is, whether it's working harder, or whether it's, you know, wanting to have more, to live in a beautiful place or to have more time to, you know, train for trail marathons. So that you have control over that, that it's not just a thing that happens to you, and that you have control over it for a really long period of time is such a freeing realization.
And for me, it would be that ambition is not something that can be neatly contained in a box labeled career, and that for many, many of these women, like two-thirds of these women that we interviewed, they consider themselves very ambitious, and yet were not trying to climb to the top of their career ladder in their field. They poured their ambition into other elements of their lives, whether it was parenting or volunteering or hobbies or whatever was important to them at that time, and that ambition really is a word, is an entity that can be freed and positivized, really, outside of career.
Great. Well, thank you. So we'll open up. We'll start over here with questions.
Sure. So you mentioned that the people you interviewed that were happiest were a little bit more flexible with what their ambition was going to be, with what their goals were. Maybe they knew in general, but didn't have a very specific. And you talked about the pressure that there is, you know, in college especially, to have like a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, and know exactly what you want. And I think for a lot of us, you know, for me anyway, there was an outline, but not really that specific. So how do you see us empowering the next generation, you know, not just women, but the kids of the next generation who, like you mentioned, they might work for a company that doesn't exist. Like, how do we empower them to embrace that without going so far as, you know, encouraging laziness or just like a lack of direction or drive?
Do you
want
to take that one?
Okay. Well, so first I want to clarify that it wasn't that they were the happiest, because happiness is a very hard thing to quantify, but they were more likely to have met their goals, which maybe leads to happiness, I don't know, or it just leads to more goals, if you're me, I don't know. So I think, I know this isn't going to exactly answer your question, but I think that for the next generation, one thing that is so important is including men in this conversation.
I was just going to say that, too.
We have done some events where men have shown up and said, like, what can I do to help support women or support my spouse or my girlfriend or whoever, my, you know, sister? And that this is not just a conversation. We can't just have an isolated conversation about women's careers without talking about the role that men play, and frankly, without making it acceptable for men to take on any range of these paths as well. So for men to choose to be opt-outers or to choose to be flex-lifers, the more that we talk about women who are successful in large part because they are married to somebody who supports them with time and who stays at home or who has downscaled his career, And the more we normalize that and say, like, this is a totally fine choice for men, the easier it will be for couples in general to shift ambition and shift who's doing what over the course of, you know, as we've talked about, that over the course of a career, you can embody all three paths. That comes with what is your partner doing? So the more flexible that men's lives look, the more flexible women's lives can look.
Hi.
Hi.
This has been a great session. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
I'm hearing you loud and clear about being open to the ebb and flow, sort of like not what you expected, what you expected. I was wondering if you talked to anyone who had had sort of like unnatural ebb and flow, like an illness that slowed or stopped their ambition?
Yes. So more in the case of women who had children who had unforeseen medical conditions, actually two, and maybe more, there's two that I'm thinking of right now. But this anecdote kind of hits a couple of themes that we've also talked about just recently. But one woman who was a healthcare sales consultant, she was an athlete in college, was very ambitious, very driven, really good at her job. And her daughter, when she was four, was diagnosed with a chronic condition that needs constant monitoring, and it is life-threatening if it's not monitored properly. And so our friend took on the role because it was very important to her and because she was more of the primary caregiver slash parent. Her partner had a job where he traveled a lot and was away from the house a lot. And so our friend ended up being the full-time medical monitor, and she took it on, and she had spreadsheets, and she became a fundraiser for the organization that was doing research on her daughter's condition. And she's now organized like multi-state runs where she's raised the most money across three states. However, because she has taken that on and that has kind of become her primary job, she no longer has time to work full time. And she had tried every iteration of working. She worked full time in an office. She worked from home. She had a job share so that she worked part time. And then the last time we interviewed her, she flat out quit that job. But the interesting point to that is that we asked her, have you asked your spouse, you know, if he could scale back his career or maybe get a different job so that he is not traveling as much, so that he is home and he can provide more support on the medical front of your child? And she said, oh, no, I could never ask him to scale back his job or get a different job. He loves his job. It's so important to him. But she, too, loved her job, and it was really important to her, too. But she, this was one of the, Jane, one of the sort of more internal obstacles. This was one of the friends who she kind of de facto prioritized her husband's career over her own because, A, he made more money, but, B, because he was a man, and she assumed, well, obviously the man has to have, she didn't say it in these words, but obviously he's the man, he is the one whose career is going to take priority. And she at one point said, I'm the parent and he's the high fiver. And, you know, comes home and says, like, how are we doing? How are we doing? We're tapering on medication? Awesome. So, so yes, due to family illnesses or people's own illnesses. And we have another friend who does not have children, but actually became a physician. And while she was in medical school at Northwestern, was diagnosed with MS. And she has, since she graduated from medical school, practiced medicine in a wheelchair. And she was so ambitious that basically she gave up walking because she continued practicing medicine and said, you know, I probably could have better health myself if I had not pursued my career with such vigor, but then I don't know who I would be if I weren't working as a physician. This was something that was so important to my parents and so important to me. But so she has sacrificed greatly and chose not to have children because she felt like she couldn't be a parent and continue being a doctor and manage her own and manage her own disease. So those are maybe a little bit more dramatic of examples than you were looking for. But yes, the people who, you know, who befell, you know, and then there's people like me and other people like me who are in the book where, you know, I worked in magazine journalism for almost 20 years, and that industry is really just kind of going down the tubes. So I've been pivoting my career and have been, you know, a freelance writer and editor and part-time stay-at-home mom for the last few years, in part by choice, but also in part by circumstance and how the industry has gone. And I'm sure there are some of you here who are in similar, if not in magazines, you're in similar industries that have morphed over the time of your career. Did that answer the question?
I think we have time for one more question. Do you want to take it?
Thanks. This has been great. Thank
awesome.
You.
Awesome. Thank you.
This is back to the theme of the importance of having a supportive partner, which I'm lucky enough to have. You talked about the importance of explicitly defining domestic roles and who does what. And you indicated you have lots of anecdotes about that. I'd love to hear, like, how does that actually look? Like, is it a chore wheel? Like, teach us how to make that happen.
It is almost a chore wheel. Well, we have one friend who
Anna has a chore wheel, actually.
I know.
A whiteboard, but
yes, we have a. Oh, I'm an organizer. I can't help it. Yes, we have a schedule. Have one friend who was a corporate lawyer and a partner in a law firm, and her husband was starting a business. They had a child and a newborn, and she felt like she was really taking on the burden of, you know, we talk a lot about emotional labor, but also just the physical, you know, minutia of our lives. And at some point, he said he was going to take a job that was going to require him to be away constantly and working constantly and also not pay very much. And she was like, no, that's not okay. And she sat down and she said, this is her quote, she said she made a list of all the bullshit things I do that he doesn't even know are things and handed it to him and said, pick half. So that's one way to do it. maybe a little more subtle, a lot of our friends talked about, they had a constant back and forth. So they would say, I feel like I am doing too much. And I will say in my own life, that I often will say, like, I feel like I there's too much on my plate right now. Here are three things. My husband gets these emails all the time. Here are three things, and I just need you to own them. And he'll do the same to me. He'll say, like, it's too much. Or I will say to him, like, you seem very stressed. Is there something that I can take off of your plate? So it is this constant conversation and rebalancing. And I will say also that I think I know this happens in my life, and I think that it also we heard it happen a lot for our friends, is that things on the women's side of the equation tend to just gravitate towards you like you're a magnet, and you just, like, all of a sudden you've got more. And so it's this constant conversation of, like, wait a minute, I am now taking on somehow way more stuff got shifted over to my side, and so let's, like, push some back. Or figure out what can be dropped, or figure out what can be outsourced. And that's something else that we haven't really touched on here, but that it's not just which spouse is doing it, but also can nobody do it? Is it a thing that you can pay somebody to do, ask a neighbor to do, get your mother-in-law to do, have a friend do, have a child
do?
Yes. So that there are a lot of different ways of looking at how to help restore that balance a little bit.
Great. Thank you for the session. Thank you, everyone, for participating.
Thank you.
You guys are awesome.
Thank you.